Good afternoon, everyone. Today is March 18th, 2013. Welcome to the Senate Committee on Healthcare and Human Services. I would like to open a work session on Senate Bill 757.
Madam Chair, I move the Dash 1 amendment to Senate Bill 757.
Senator Cruz moves the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 757. Sandy, do you just want to remind us what this bill is?
Madam Chair, members of the committees, Senate Bill 757, you'll recall, we heard last week, authorizes the health authority to operate the Senior Farm Direct Nutrition Program should the partnership between the federal government, for whatever reason, go awry. And this just grants them the authority to run the program with the funding that they have on board. The Dash 1 amendment specifies the program as the Senior Farm Direct Nutrition Program. That's all the amendment does. There's no fiscal impact and there's no revenue impact, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Is there any discussion on the Dash 1 amendments? Any opposition? So ordered.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 757 as amended by the Dash 1 amendment to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 757 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Yes, Senator Cruz.
Madam Chair, declare a potential conflict of interest. I do have a farm stand.
All right.
That is not a potential conflict of interest because you're in a large class.
I understand
All right. So, clerk will call the roll.
Senator Steiner-Hayward.
Aye.
Senator Canoe.
Aye.
Senator Shields.
Aye.
Senator Cruz.
Aye.
Senator Sanderson. Aye. Motion carries, and Senator Thompson will carry this bill. He came and testified, or at least wanted to testify. With that, I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 757, and I want to open an informational meeting on the state of diabetes in Oregon, and I want to call Scott Bruin and Katie Bruin, who was just diagnosed with diabetes, and I think I'm going to come down there and tell you what they put me through.
There you go, sir.
So, Madam Chair, do you want to go first or let
yeah,
that?
I'll okay. go first. Okay. Then I can come back and join you. All right. Good afternoon. I'm State Senator Lori Montes-Anderson. I represent Gresham, Troutdale, Wood Village, and Fairview. And we are going to talk about diabetes for a while. And boy, did they put me through the rigor. They said, they want me to pretend that I have diabetes. And so they gave me this little book, all right, and I had to test my blood sugar before I ate my lunch, which was an orange and some angel hair pasta. Then I had to count the carbohydrates that were in that food. And they gave me another little book, calorie, fat, and carbohydrate counter, and sort of figure out how much carbohydrates was in the food that I ate. And then I had to make sure that I had one unit of insulin for every 10 grams of carbohydrates. And then 2 hours after I ate, I had to also then check my blood sugar. And, you know, I don't think I could do this job as a legislator, because we're always on the fly if I were diabetic. It is really a 24/7, you have to be aware of it 24/7. My sister's diabetic, so I know a little bit about it, and I have had some patients who were diabetic in the past. But if I was too low, I had to take 4 of these glucose tablets, or I could have drank half of this if my blood sugar was, say, 60. So anyway, there's a whole lot to learn. And when you have type 1 diabetes, I think that we really need to pay more attention to it as a state. And I want two people who have diabetes, type 1 diabetes, to come tell us a little bit about what it is like to live with diabetes, as well as why we as a state really need to be taking this seriously. Because if you listened to my remonstrance today on the floor, recent estimates project that as many as 1 in 3 American adults will have diabetes in 2050 if the current trends continue. So we right now need to start addressing that issue. And I know that we do have a bill, Senate Bill 169, that we are struggling with the Oregon Health Authority, but we hope to hopefully have something that we can work with soon. So with that, I will turn it over to the stars of the show.
Shouldn't you have measured your food before you ate it?
She did. I did.
No, you said after you ate it, you had to measure it, and I'm thinking...
No, the insulin.
Okay.
They'll explain it more. If I did it wrong...
You confused me.
Okay.
Please, Scott, go ahead.
Absolutely. Well, thank you, Mr. Vice Chair. Appreciate the opportunity to be here today, and very much appreciate the chair sort of spending a few hours, if you will, in the living the day-to-day life of somebody with diabetes. We are here. I'm Scott Bruin from Westland, Oregon. This is my daughter, Katie Bruin, also from Westland, Oregon, and we're here as just we have the honor to be just the two of about 40 or 50 of us that are representing the American Diabetes Association today from all over Oregon and Southwest Washington, and we represent both kinds of diabetes, and I'll get into a little bit more detail on that, but I want to start by, again, introducing Catherine Bruin, and she's got a little something she wants to share.
Okay. My name is Catherine Bruin. I'm a fifth grader in Westland, Oregon. Yeah. First, I would like to thank you for taking time off of your busy schedule to be here today. Thank you for supporting or about to become supporters of the American Diabetes Association Search for a Cure. Diabetes is a disease that injures many Americans. I have been affected by it since as long as I can remember. My dad has had type 1 for about 30 years and counting, but I was not completely affected until about 7 months ago. I was on vacation in Central Oregon when I started showing early symptoms of diabetes, constantly going to the bathroom, having unquenchable thirst, and craving sugar. On the last morning of our trip, my dad decided to check my blood sugar. It was well over 300 and definitely out of normal range. We packed up and headed home, then got right back up and went to the hospital. The last 7 months since that have been frustrating, filled with staying up late to test my blood sugar just one more time, and pretending I'm fine when I'm actually not. It would be impossible for a non-diabetic to know the pain diabetics go through every day. If we find a cure for this terrifying disease, no one will know that pain anymore. Thank you again for inviting us today, and please help us find a cure.
Thank you, Katie, so much for coming and sharing your story.
Nice job.
So, again, thank you for having us. So what we want to do today is just sort of share a little bit of the state of diabetes in Oregon, and probably the best way to start with that story is just to give you a quick state of diabetes in this nation. Katie and I, as well as 200 other advocates from across the country, actually had a real honor to go to Washington, D.C. It was not last week, but the week before, to lobby Congress for the similar things that we're here in front of you today. What we learned at that meeting, and they just released the new numbers, but in the last in the last 5 years, those with diabetes and the cost of diabetes have increased 41%, if I'm not mistaken. What we're seeing in the United States right now is that we're spending $245 billion a year on the care and treatment of diabetes. And again, that's up 41%. So that's $245 billion on state and federal taxpayers, $245 billion on individual Americans, and $245 billion on those of us who pay the insurance bills. It's just staggering, and that doesn't even account for the tens of billions more that we spend on heart disease and stroke, eye disease, kidney disease, those sorts of issues that are related to diabetes. Actually, that $245 billion is a conservative number. Here in Oregon, as you can imagine, the statistics are equally as daunting. We have about 248,000 people in Oregon that have diabetes, two types of diabetes, type 1 and type 2. The type of diabetes that Kate and I have, there's about 15,000 to 20,000 with that type of diabetes, but the whole population, about 248,000. $20,000. And we're spending, and this is, you know, part of our just helping you understand what the issues are. The state of Oregon spends $2.99 billion per year, again, on the care and treatment of diabetes. That, again, as I mentioned earlier with the national statistics, does not include the costs, the acute and chronic costs of those other diseases that are related to diabetes. And so, you know, as you think about, you know, one of my pleas is as you think about the dollars that you spend, the dollars that, you know, the every 2 years we go through the challenges of trying to manage the budgets, and I remember and I know how difficult that is to do and how many demands on limited resources there are. Think about the cost of $3 billion, almost probably closer to $4 billion, to the state of Oregon when you're thinking about dollars that you spend, that you budget for diabetes education, diabetes prevention. What we, you know, we talk about in our house is, you know, a few cents to get us better educated, if you will, a few cents spent to hopefully, especially with type 2, to keep people from getting diabetes, to live those healthier lifestyles, to educate them, saves much, much more than that. So I always looked at when I was in your chair, you know, regardless of how I felt about diabetes, I felt that to do my fiduciary responsibility to the taxpayers of the state of Oregon, I better have my arms around diabetes and what it's doing in this state, because it is very, very expensive. Just to give you a little personal background about how we got here, I've had diabetes for 31 years, and as I joked in the healthcare committee earlier, I've given myself about 50,000 shots and have tested my blood about 80,000 times, so I'm well aerated at this point. Years ago, when I was a much younger man, I was very active in diabetes sorts of issues, very much an advocate, and just as with anything in life, you sort of move on to the next thing, and I had very much done that. I'd sort of moved on past diabetes. Even politics was part of that. And then as Katie mentioned, about 7 months ago, we were vacationing in Central Oregon, just our week we spend there every year before school starts. And she was extremely thirsty and also tired, gaunt and thin, all the telltale signs, early signs of the disease. However, she's also growing, and we were in a hot place, and we're all very active. So we you know, Dad wanted to ascribe that, if you will, to she's just growing. But eventually it got to the point where, in fact, her older sister came downstairs one morning and said that she had barely slept. And I asked why. And she said, well, because Katie was up, you know, seven times during the night to go to the bathroom. And, you know, Dad with diabetes radar goes up. I when she gets up in the morning, I had her do that blood test. And as she said, it was well over 300. For a dad, that was very hard. It was like a knife in the chest. So when we talk about these numbers, when we talk about the 248,000 people with diabetes in Oregon, when we talk about the 25 million people with diabetes across the United States, those are and the dollars we spend, those are very important numbers, very important to understand. But also remember, as I know you will, that with each of those numbers has a personal story behind it. So it's 25 million nationwide, there's 240, you know, quarter million in Oregon. There's a story similar to ours for each of those. And so we appreciate your work. We appreciate your service. We do ask you to look at Senate Bill 169, and even with the challenges, we certainly support moving that forward. And we also ask you to make sure, if you will, to look strongly at the CCO Medicaid expansion programs. I know that's various bills, but that's very important when it comes to the medication, the education, and the medical devices. So with that, it was very long-winded. I apologize, but we thank you, and we'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Any discussion?
Yes, just make a quick comment, and thank you both so much for coming today, and Katie in particular for sharing your story. You know, I'm a family physician in the rest of my life, and one of the biggest challenges I think we face when we think about diabetes is separating out how we think about type 1 and type 2 diabetes. You know, with your family clearly represents the genetic component that comes with both types of diabetes, but they're very different diseases. They have some of the same manifestations, but they're very different diseases in a lot of different, as you well know. And at the moment, there's not much we can do to prevent type 1 diabetes. We don't know enough about what triggers it to be able to do much to prevent it. We do think that there are some things we can do to certainly reduce the risk for type 2 diabetes. And so we have to think about aggressive treatment for people with type 1 diabetes to prevent the lifelong complications. And you're a great example of how you can manage well, if you're careful about it, you know, you stay healthy for a long time. And I hope that, Katie, that will be true for you as well. Do you like Katie or Catherine better?
Either.
Okay. Yeah. I'm an Elizabeth who hates Liz. So, but I really want us to be thinking carefully about the fact that we can actually do a lot to help people stay active and healthy and hopefully reduce risks of type 2 diabetes. We're not seeing a significant rise in the incidence rate of people developing type 1 diabetes. We are seeing people your age, Katie, getting type 2 diabetes, which we never saw before. It's a new problem, and we really need to be thinking about it. So one of the things I would ask of you is that you talk to your friends and say, look, there was nothing I could do to prevent this, but you can make good choices. You, my friends, can make good choices. And let me help you and let me show you about being active and things like that, eating a healthy diet. And that doesn't mean never having candy. Even like for you, it doesn't mean never having candy. It just means being really thoughtful about it. And you're going to be a great spokesman for helping people understand this is not how they want to spend their lives. So thank you in advance for the work you're doing.
Thank you, Senator, for taking
your time, Representative, to come and talk with us.
Thank you.
Senator Shields?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Bruin, I just wanted to tell you that your testimony today was the best testimony I've heard all day, and I'm sincere.
Thank you.
Testimony.
Absolutely true. All right. I would like to ask Dr. From the Diabetes Clinic, who is sitting in the back of the room. And
Dr. Almond.
Yeah. Could you come forward? I know you don't have any, but I so want the committee to know about your clinic. One of them knows about it, but could you just talk about your clinic?
Okay, the Harold Schnitzer Diabetes
Center. Oh, introduce yourself.
Oh, I'm sorry. Andy Almond from Portland. The Harold Schnitzer Diabetes Center is up at OHSU, and I'm the director of that center. It's a combined pediatric and adult diabetes center, which is quite unique. In fact, the only one on the West Coast that has adults and peds, as well as all the education components, and we have social work component and psychological component, particularly for the pediatric side. And we say our goal is actually helping, because of the technological aspects of type 1 diabetes, being expert in the care of type 1 in our own facility, taking care of complicated type 2 diabetes, but probably our biggest role is advocacy and outreach throughout the state to try and help the big epidemic that you're referring to. I will say that there actually is a little bit of evidence that type 1 diabetes is increasing, especially in the Northwest, and that may be a genetic thing, maybe some other things. We're actually part of the center has accomplished great things in recent years because of this joint effort and because I think the way we've been positioned recently. So we're also part of a national database of about 26,000 people with type 1 diabetes. And so the lifestyle things actually now apply to people with type 1 because in that database, 67% of the people with type 1 are either overweight or obese. So they reflect the normal population. And so many of the same things, especially when it comes to reducing the complications of diabetes, are relevant in terms of keeping active and working on diet and so forth. But we've been very fortunate. We're working on a program that was sponsored through Senate Bill 787A a couple years ago that's to try and progress in terms of new methods of dealing with patients who are at high risk, who have complicated treatments of diabetes through a telephone system of communicating with them, not having them come into the office all the time. And Regents is the first one to collaborate with us on, and we hope to expand that in the few months ahead. Any specific questions?
Thank you so much. I really do hope that starting with our coordinated care organizations, which of course are just for our low income, that these coordinated care organizations will implement diabetes education early on. And that is definitely talking about all the costs. And we at least start with that population in that can just expand then to the rest of the population if we can prove, by addressing this issue, preferably before they're diagnosed with type 2.
Yeah, I suspect that you'll see this multiple times over the next several years, diabetes prevention program. It's a program that sort of evolved over the last decade and is now endorsed and crystallized a little bit by the Center for Disease Control, and there's more opportunities to roll it out in the country, so insurers will try to do this. But actually, just on Friday and Saturday, we had the first training that was actually through the Oregon Health Authority giving money to help us do some training. And we had training for people in Providence and people in the African American Health Coalition and people from the Asian Health Coalition or whatever the particular terminology is. And I think we had a total of about seven different entities who had members to train how to do peer group education around diabetes prevention for people who are either pre-diabetes or at high risk for diabetes. And I hope that that will be something that will grow in a CCO kind of environment. And the American Diabetes Association is a strong supporter of diabetes prevention programs because they've been shown to be cost effective. In fact, with the peer group types of training that we're talking about, the prices are such that it's thought to be cost savings, that you actually end up, there's almost nothing we do nowadays that's in that category. So this will be an important effort that falls in the lines of what you're referring to. So,
great. Well, thank you so very much. Any other discussion? All right. Thank you very much. Is there anyone else that wants to come and talk about diabetes? All right. Thank you so much. And keep on us. You know, to do this. Thank you. That will close the informational hearing on diabetes and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 569. Sandy, bring us up to date here.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 569 requires the Oregon Health Authority to adopt uniform credentialing and privileging standards for providers of telemedicine services. It authorizes a hospital to accept credentials of telemedicine providers either by an agreement with a distant site hospital or by providers meeting the credentialing and privileging standards already established by the authority. This has an emergency clause effective on passage. I believe that we did put a dash one amendment on there, but those are outdated. There are more coming.
Great. Thank you. All right. Senator Steiner Hayward, and are you Miles Ellenby? All right.
Sorry, we took the liberty of coming up early. For the record, Madam Chair, I'm Senator Elizabeth Steiner Hayward, representing what I like to call the most diverse district in Oregon, a.k.a. District 17. And I'm here today to testify in support of Senate Bill 569, which will provide a uniform standard for telemedicine credentialing across Oregon. So let me start by explaining what telemedicine is. And telemedicine is using telecommunication and other technology from hospital to hospital to provide health care at a distance. And this is particularly important in a state like Oregon, where we have a vast area of our state that's primarily rural, and that medical expertise is centralized, especially the higher-level medical expertise, is centralized in a few urban areas. We want to be able to provide healthcare services across the state at the same level, and telemedicine allows us to do that. It can provide ongoing care, such as specialized neurology care for people with chronic neurologic diseases. It can also provide critical care and emergency services, and Dr. Ellenby will explain more about that in a moment. Telemedicine really makes it possible to provide these services, but the biggest barrier to this has turned out to be getting our staff credentialed at different facilities. And as you probably know, physicians, in order to practice at a hospital, have to have very specific credentials and they have to be approved by the hospital to practice. So I'm going to introduce Dr. Ellenby, and honestly, Madam Chair, the biggest moral of this story is be careful who you sit next to on an airplane. Because this all came about because I was flying, I can't even remember where we were flying, but there was Miles Ellenby sitting next to me on the plane, or not even sitting next to me, in the back of the plane, and ended up in a seat next to me when telling me about this problem. And I said, oh, this is something I could actually help do something about. So without further ado, let me introduce Dr. Ellenby and allow him to explain a little bit more about himself and the problem we're facing.
Thank you. Chair Montez Anderson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dr. Miles Ellenby. I'm a pediatric ICU doctor at OHSU's Dornbecker Children's Hospital. I'm also the medical director of the university's telemedicine program. First, I'd like to thank Senator Steiner Hayward for her leadership and efforts to bring down some of the barriers we're facing in expanding telemedicine services across Oregon. Oregon Health and Science University strongly supports Senate Bill 569. To provide a standardization of telemedicine credentialing requirements across the state. I'm happy to report that in Oregon, in the past 5 years, access to emergency specialty medical care has been greatly enhanced by the growth of these services. About half the hospitals in the state of Oregon now have the ability to consult with specialists by video conference over secure broadband connections. As a clinician, often consulted in these acute situations, I can tell you that the difference between the quality of information received via phone call versus that gained by video is dramatic, and at times life-saving. In a matter of a few years, telemedicine has made it possible for OHSU stroke neurologists, pediatric and neonatal intensive care physicians, genetic specialists, psychiatrists, and other medical experts to treat patients almost anywhere in the state. In fact, the telemedicine network has expanded its offerings, allowing patients in over a dozen communities to have access to our services minutes after they arrive in their local emergency room. Since May 2010 alone, our specialists have performed over 400 acute care consults, assisting local physicians with treatment and transfer decisions. This ranges from reassuring the local team about the appropriateness of their treatment plan to actually helping resuscitate patients. Not only has this saved lives, OHSU telemedicine has also allowed hundreds of patients to remain in their home communities for medical care and has saved more than $2 million in transport costs alone. If we were to look at the savings provided by all the telemedical providers throughout the state, that number would be significantly higher. There are still many Oregonians with unmet needs in our rural communities. The continued expansion of telemedicine services throughout the state will help meet the triple aim of healthcare transformation. However, a 20th century regulatory system still hampers our ability to deliver 21st century care when it's most urgently needed. Most challenging is the requirement for each physician providing telemedicine to be credentialed at each hospital where services are provided. Credentialing can mean each of our physicians and our credentialing team has to compile dozens of pages of documentation for every hospital where they provide these consultations. Because individual hospitals often have different requirements, new credentialing packets have to be created each time a new physician is added. Multiply this requirement by Oregon's 58 hospitals, and the bureaucratic challenge becomes staggering. Despite movement at the federal level to modernize some of these requirements, this remains our greatest roadblock to expanding access to medical care through telemedicine. Senate Bill 569 seeks to standardize these requirements in order to provide some stability in the credentialing application process. As a physician, I fully understand and respect the needs of a hospital's governing body to credential their medical staff in order to determine if a healthcare provider is eligible to receive privileges at their facility, both for those providers that serve patients in person and those that serve patients via telepresence. Senate Bill 569 does not aim to change this important responsibility, but simply seeks to provide stability and standardization to the process while working within the constraint of federal regulations. We have only uncovered the tip of the iceberg that is the immense potential of telemedicine to transform access to healthcare. As Oregon blazes the way in healthcare reform, we must do everything possible to facilitate these new delivery models that have been proven to simultaneously achieve all three of the IHI's triple aims: better care for individuals, better health for populations, and a lower per capita cost. Telemedicine does just that. Senate Bill 569 will help to break down the barriers to expanding telemedical services to every hospital in Oregon. With that, I'll turn it back over to Senator Hayward.
Thank you so much, Dr. Ellenby. I really appreciate it. So let me explain the practicalities of this bill. What's going to happen is that the health authority will get together with any interested stakeholders, and that could be health systems like OHSU or Providence or Legacy that are providing telemedicine services, and hospitals in rural communities, or even some of the hospitals go back and forth. Some of the Providence hospitals get telemedicine services, some of the Legacy hospitals get telemedicine services, and then, of course, some of the smaller rural hospitals get telemedicine services. So they'll convene a group of stakeholders to develop a standardized list of credentials, and that can include things such as diplomas, board certification, licensure, recent peer references, lists of the privileges that the providers hold at their home hospital. And those will be the standard list. There will also be a list of things that they may also request, and then there are going to be a list of things that they can't request. For example, one of the things that Dr. Ellenby told me when we're traveling is that some of the remote hospitals, because it was part of their standard credentialing packet and they had no choice, were requesting proof that the person had been tested to prove that they didn't have tuberculosis. Now, I have not figured out how we transmit tuberculosis over Skype. Just doesn't work. So we're going to take that one off the list. They can't really ask for that one. If they're not going to be setting foot in the hospital, we don't have to worry about that too much. And the hospitals that are then receiving these services will be able to request that standard list of credentials plus anything that they want on the May request list. And so the base hospitals, what we're actually calling, just to confuse us, distant site hospitals in the bill, and these are defined in the bill because I got very confused anyway, the distant site hospitals where people like Dr. LNB are based will keep a standard packet for every physician who's going to be providing telemedicine services that they'll be able to transmit instantly to any originating site hospital. That's where the patients are. And that will be very clear. Hospitals that are originating site hospitals that are receiving telemedicine services will be able to either delegate credentialing, which is to say to OHSU, yes, we're just going to accept your credentialing of Dr. LNB, and we'll just take that as good. And there's precedent for doing that, and that's completely acceptable under federal regulation. Or they'll be able to say, no, we want to do our own credentialing. Please send us the standard packet, plus these additional documents or kinds of information that are on the May provide list. And the local hospital will always have the final decision-making capacity, as Dr. LNB mentioned. So we're not taking away any local control with this bill. We're just trying to make it a little bit more uniform, a little bit cleaner, and to expedite the process so that we don't delay delivery of services. I really want to thank this, you know, this bill is a great example of an idea that came about from an airplane ride and some frustration about providing services to a group from across the state and even across borders, because we had participation, for example, from St. Al's in Boise that has Oregon patients there, to a large group of people getting together and really being thoughtful about what the concerns were about this bill, spending a couple hours holed up in a room together and being very open about their concerns and very thoughtful about how we address them. So I want to thank OHSU, Providence, Legacy, Kaiser, and the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems for their hard work in addressing the concerns, and certainly the health authority for the work that they have done and will be doing. This is, as Dr. LNB mentioned, a way to substantially improve access to health care across Oregon, streamline services, and reduce regulation of the wrong kinds, and ensure patient safety while we're providing these services, and ultimately reduce costs while improving care. So thank you in advance for your support of Senate Bill 569. We're happy to take questions.
Why don't we call up Andy Easton from the Hospital Association, and while she's coming up, I've had talks with representatives of OHSU as well as the Hospital Association, and it appears that there still needs to be some work done on the bill, and so we'll let Andy present.
Okay. Chair Monis Anderson and members of the committee, I'm Andy Easton, the Associate Vice President of Government Affairs for the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. And I do want to express my appreciation to Senator Steiner Hayward and OHSU for bringing this bill forward. Medicine has changed dramatically over the years. And 10 years ago, we were just on the verge of talking about telemedicine. And today, we are using telemedicine across our state, across the nation, to provide access to health care. That is a great thing. But one of our concerns that we laid out in our meetings with the senator and with OHSU was the concern around whether or not this would set a separate standard for telemedicine providers on the privileging side. There are two ways that a hospital credentials and privileges, or there's two ways that a hospital ensures the competency of a provider, and that is through the credentialing process, for which I think Dr. LNB described very clearly, and that's the gathering the information of who that provider is, making sure that they have the education and the training, as well as the license to practice medicine. And then the privileging piece is very unique to each hospital. It is set up by their medical bylaws, which is by their medical staff, and it's approved by the hospital board. And in those privileges, it really looks at what scope of practice that provider can provide in healthcare services for that facility. In Oregon, we have 58 hospitals. If you roll up those hospitals into systems, we have 36 unique hospitals across the state. And there would be 36 universe or different credentialing and privileging services there that hospitals would require. The association is neutral on this bill. We have members who provide telemedicine services who are very much in favor of this process. We have individuals who are already delegating their credentialing, and privileging to the distant hospital. But then we have a few who really find that the privileging piece is very sacred and needs to stay within the hospital's authority to make that decision. I would say I think we have addressed that in possibly in one of the amendments that is coming forth. And I think Senator Steiner Hayward alluded to that the hospital would have the final decision in the approval of that provider. And that is very comforting to hear. But we still have a few members, including St. Charles, who is very concerned that this sets a separate standard for telemedicine providers.
Thank you very much. All right. So I know you're going to have amendments coming forward, and any questions for the panel?
Could I make a comment, Madam mm-hmm. Chair? Thank you. You know, one of the challenges that we face is this distinction that Ms. Easton just pointed out between credentialing and privileging. They are two entirely separate processes, and this bill is really intended to address credentialing only. It is not intended to address privileging specifically. And the intent of this bill was never to take away any local hospital's right to make decisions about credentialing in and of itself, or privileging for that matter. That decision would still rest with the hospital receiving the telemedicine services. It was simply to standardize the kinds of documentation that would need to be provided for the credentialing process. And privileges are an entirely separate set of things. At the moment, and Dr. Ellenby, you can correct me if I'm wrong, at the moment, I believe the vast majority, if not the entirety, of telemedicine services being provided in this state are thought, conversation only, as opposed to physical hands-on skills, which are very different from the kinds of things. For example, as a family physician at OHSU, I can be privileged to do outpatient care only, and in the context of outpatient care, certain kinds of laceration repairs or outpatient procedures. I can be credentialed to privileged to do inpatient care, but perhaps not intensive care, or intensive care, but not certain procedures that are common to intensive care, to provide maternity care, but only vaginal births as opposed to cesarean sections. There's a range of things, and those are the things that fall under privileges. But the credentialing process is simply saying, yes, I'm a licensed board-certified physician who's maintained. I'm just going through my reprivileging, recredentialing process at OHSU right now. I literally spent a couple hours online yesterday doing this. So I'm actually very personally familiar with this right now. And I have to document that I've been doing the work that I should be doing to keep up the privileges that I have. But the credentials relate to, do I have a valid Oregon license? Do I have a valid DEA license? Have I actually done, in general, the continuing medical education that I need to do to stay credentialed as a physician? And I really want to make this distinction. This bill was entirely intended to deal with the credentialing process, not the privileging process. And we do have amendments that we hashed through, I think, on Friday that I think address the vast majority, if not all, of the hospital association's concerns, and we hope to have those ready in the next couple of days for you.
Now, I know that this is for physicians and PAs only, and I was just curious.
Actually, it says providers.
Providers, so it would include nurse practitioners?
Okay. Yeah, although at the moment, I don't think there are nurse practitioners or PAs, for that matter, providing telemedicine services. I think it's only physicians, but we wanted to keep it broader so that we didn't have to go back and do a fix later on, because as these things expand and as the role of nurse practitioners and PAs expand, especially maybe in terms of follow-up care, it may be appropriate to allow those providers to provide these services.
Great.
We wanted to keep it broad in the context of team-based care.
Thank you. Any other comments?
Do you want to add anything about the privileging versus credentialing issue? I may have misspoken on something.
No, I think your comments are accurate, and we have a defined set of privileges at these facilities. It's to provide video consultation within our specialty of pediatric critical care or neonatology and so forth. So there are not hands-on procedures. And I don't believe anybody in the state is doing robotic surgery. That's something that's a whole other level of telemedicine where, yes, then privileging is critical, is whether you're privileged to do that type of activity.
Remote robotic?
Yes.
Wow.
They're doing that in other parts of the country, but we're just not.
I suppose because he's in a console anyway, isn't he? So,
right. Yeah. But yeah. We're not doing that here. Yeah.
Well, I know it's in the best interest of the patient to have as much telemedicine, I feel, as possible, even in diabetes. And we just had a diabetes, a lot of education can be
if
done.
If I may, Madam Chair, I think that's a really important point. You know, if someone in John Day has a complicated case of diabetes and they're getting great care from their local physician, but they still need more consultation, asking them to drive 5 hours to Portland when they could get a consultation with Dr. Amin or his colleagues via telemedicine is not very patient-centered care.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
It takes them out of work for 2 days. It takes time. It takes more time from Dr. Amin's schedule than it would, you know, if he could do it remotely. I think we really need to be thinking about patient-centered care because, frankly, people are likely to delay necessary care if it's a huge physical inconvenience for them, and we don't want that to be a barrier to optimal care. So.
All right. Thank you, and we'll be waiting for the amendments.
Thanks, Andy.
And just before you
close
this, we did get some written testimony from the Telehealth Alliance of Oregon. It should be in your packet with the bill.
Thank you.
As well as I have some from Oregon Health and Science University that gave us some background on streamlining telemedicine credentialing. All right. Thank you. And with that, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 569 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 753. Sandy? Tell us about this bill.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, this bill is brought forward to the committee by Senators Canope and Senator Cruz, both members of your illustrious committee here. This requires the Oregon Health Authority to request specified information from potential contractors and, if certain conditions are met, to request proposals to establish and operate systems and technologies designed to detect and prevent improper payments in the state medical assistance program. This declares an emergency as an effective on passage. And this does have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Okay. Senator Canope.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee colleagues. For the record, my name is Tim Canope, State Senator from District 27, representing the Central Oregon communities of Bend, Redmond, Sun River, and Tumalo. And Madam Chair, thank you for having a public hearing on this important issue. Already this session has created tremendous tension over looming budget shortfalls, and being good stewards of Oregon taxpayer resources requires us to make tough choices. And while many of these policy choices can regress into partisan arguments, few have the bipartisan appeal of fighting fraud. Being vigilant against those that would game and cheat the state of Oregon is a policy area that I take very personally, and that's why I'm before you today. Senate Bill 753 is an effort to bring the latest in fraud-fighting technology to the state of Oregon. It's about prevention and detection. And if you haven't seen it, I would encourage you to take a look at the Office of Payment Accuracy and Recovery, the OPAR report. The state of Oregon is doing some good things as it relates to this area. And what my bill suggests is that we move more quickly from a pay-and-chase model to a preventative model. The federal government estimates that Medicaid programs pay around $18 billion a year, an average of $360 million per year, that's attributed to fraud, waste, and abuse, taxpayer money that could be used for other helpful purposes. To combat this problem, this legislation would implement modern fraud screening and prevention solutions to detect fraud and abuse prior to Medicaid claims being paid. Common practice is to pay claims as they come in and later attempt to recover the claims that are found to be fraudulent. Over the last 2 years, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, CMS, has implemented powerful new anti-fraud tools designed and implemented as a large-scale innovative improvements to our Medicare program and its integrity, and it's really trying to shift from a pay-and-chase model approach to preventing fraud before it happens, reducing both improper payments and the cost and time involved in traditional pan chase recovery. Just last year, the state of Washington overwhelmingly passed its bill to apply this fraud-fighting technology to the state's Medicaid program. Oregon needs to join Washington State as a leader in fighting and preventing Medicaid fraud. Obviously, part of the reason to do this is other states move in that direction. The folks who would like to perpetrate this fraud tend to find homes, and we prefer one of those homes is not in Oregon. Implementing strong preventative controls can help defend against improper payments, increasing public confidence, and avoiding the difficult pay and chase aspects of recovering improper payments. With Medicaid fraud becoming increasingly more complex, it's critical that Oregon updates and improves its policies to remain vigilant. Senate Bill 753 adds technologies necessary to assure the long solvency of Medicaid, ensuring that these critical programs will be available for those who truly need the help. As I discussed earlier, being vigilant on fraud isn't a partisan issue. With the encouraging early results of CMS transition towards stronger preventative measures, similar legislation to ours is being introduced in 37 states this year. I'm happy to say that this bill is no different. I'm honored to have the support of our good Vice Chair and Dr. Bates to show their bipartisan support for this important legislation, and I would be honored if you would join me as well. It's time to bring the latest in fraud-fighting technology to the state of Oregon, and I thank you for your time.
Great. Do you want to stay there while is it Noah Rendier? Rending?
Yeah, I'd be happy to.
Riandon.
Riandon.
Blame the French for that one, right?
Riandon.
Excellent. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Noah Riando, and I'm here today on behalf of MDON. MDON is one of the many companies that could provide some of the technologies referenced in Senate Bill 753. This short bill could save Oregon millions of dollars during these tough budget times by preventing unnecessary fraud, waste, and abuse. As you heard from Senator Knope, the federal government estimates that state Medicaid programs pay around $18 billion annually. It's an average of $360 million annually per state per year that is attributed to fraud, waste, and abuse. And that's simply taxpayer money that could be used for better purposes. While saving Oregon millions of dollars a year, this legislation should have no upfront cost, shouldn't be a fiscal note since it could be based upon the industry standard contingency model, and that is a percentage of the achieved savings. One of the reasons that I came down from Olympia today is that I had the pleasure of working with Representative Kevin Parker up in Washington State last year on his House Bill 2571. And for those of you who like college basketball, that would be the same Washington that lost to the Oregon Ducks before you guys won the tournament here in the Pac-10 just a couple days ago. But I wanted to share my experiences from the work up in Washington, which I thought could be helpful to this conversation. When Representative Parker introduced his bill, I got to say it was a long shot. As a member of the minority party, the majority controlled both houses, the legislature and the governor's office, and not a lot of the minorities' bills were going through. So that bill stood kind of long odds. And in addition to that, there were concerns that were addressed by the Washington Medical Association. That's our doctors up in Washington State. Specifically, and I want to be candid about this, they were concerned about two things, and that was that their payments would be delayed, mm-hmm. And that it would require an extra step for them to get paid each time they submit a claim. And the state agency up in Washington State charged with implementing the bill, or that would be charged with implementing the bill, also expressed opposition and claimed that the state was already taking actions on Medicaid fraud. So, combined with being in the minority party and fighting the doctors and the state was, I got to say, we didn't have very much of a chance up in Washington State. Nonetheless, as the legislation was introduced and the conversation moved forward, we found a number of things along the way and the concerns were able to be addressed. Specifically, we found that rather than delaying all payments, implementing upfront prevention and detection solutions to assure that only valid claims are paid only resulted in about 1 in 1,000 claims being flagged, and most of those could be resolved in 24 hours. In addition, So this new method didn't adversely affect or put too much of a burden on the doctors, because there also wasn't an extra step that they had to do each time they submitted a claim. It was only one time upfront registration. So that really addressed their concerns, and they didn't have opposition. They just testified on the opposite house that, you know, that they wanted to make sure that those weren't a problem. So those were able to be addressed. And finally, while the state was doing some things to prevent fraud, there were some key items in the bill that the state wasn't doing but could be doing to add significant savings. And so in the end, this legislator in the minority's long shot bill that was probably doomed from the beginning ended up passing 96-1 and 49-0. So then after the bill passed last year, word kind of got around in the interim, and 39 bills of a similar nature, kind of mostly based upon that piece of legislation and what ultimately went through in Washington State, have been introduced so far in 2013. So this is one of the most popular bills in the country, is getting a lot of attention because of the size of the savings that can be achieved. And just kind of conclusion, you know, as I said before, the federal government estimates that Medicaid fraud amounts to about $360 million a year. I don't want to pretend that this bill is going to get, you know, all $360 million if Oregon's an average state. But I do think it can take a significant slice out of that. And so I'd urge your support.
How much does it cost? How much would it cost the state?
So, I mean, one of the things that the bill mentions, and I think rightly so, is it could be based upon what's kind of the industry standard contingency model. So only the state would only pay a portion of the achieved savings. So essentially, if there wasn't any savings, you would pay nothing. If you, you know, recovered millions of dollars, then you'd only pay a percentage of those millions of dollars that you'd recover. And so it really incentivizes a couple things. One is the vendor to help find as much fraud as possible and to, you know, not just collect a paycheck, they actually do something. And second is, I thought it was a great approach in Oregon with, you know, putting out the request to, you know, get all this, solicit as many comments as you can from as many vendors as possible on the different models they could use, and to pick the best one possible, so let the marketplace, you know, get the biggest bang for the buck that you could for Oregon.
So what would be the upfront cost for the state of Oregon, do you think, or what was the if you say it depends on savings, what was the upfront cost for the state of Washington?
Nothing.
I mean, give me sort of a ballpark figure.
Zero. So again, as a percentage.
Zero.
Of, zero.
As a percentage, I want that on the record. You didn't say it.
Yeah.
Thank you. Yes. Senator Steiner Hayward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Riando, does Washington have an estimate at this point as to how much they think they've prevented in fraudulent claims at this point? I mean, where were they? I mean, how long has it actually been implemented? And during that period of time, what's been and how are they measuring that?
The last I'd heard, they'd put out a solicitation, and I think they'd received this responses, but I don't think a decision had been made. I could be wrong about that, because I'm not tracking that effort.
I'm sorry, so let me clarify.
Yeah.
Because it says here that that the implementing only resulted in about 1 in 1,000 claims being delayed, so that's a hypothetical.
Yeah,
as to what would be delayed. So Washington hasn't actually implemented this
that's
yet.
That's correct.
They've still got their RFP out, and they're still waiting for a decision about which vendor they're going to be working with?
I believe that's correct.
Got it. Thank you very
much. Yes, Senator Cruz.
I have a more important question. Oregon beat Washington and then UCLA, so how come Oregon's a 12 seed and UCLA's a 7? Can you explain that to me?
There's a lot of things I can and I can't explain. That's one of the ones I'm afraid has left others.
Madam Chair and Senator Cruz, that would be NCAA bracket fraud is what that is.
Would this bill help?
Dr. Goldberg, would you like to come up and talk about how we're dealing with fraud and your take on this bill?
Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee, for the record, Bruce Goldberg, Director of the Oregon Health Authority. The answer to Senator Cruz's question is really predictive modeling. It's exactly what these systems do. It's past performance is future performance is based on predicting from the past. Now, having gotten myself in a bit of trouble, let me try and work my way.
I actually want a bad answer, Bruce. So.
As I think committee members know, as an agency, we've been trying to be neutral on bills. Having said that, this is a good bill. And I'll tell you why. As Senator Knope indicated, we've actually been making steady progress in what we've been doing as a state in trying to do the best we can in eliminating fraud within our Medicaid program and within our other public programs. We've been making consistent investments in our Office of Payment and Recovery. Over this current biennium, we estimate we will bring in about $53 million or $57 million in revenue that we would have lost, that we're recovering, and about $113 million in what we call cost avoidance. The payments didn't go out, but we avoided them going out. That most of that gets split with the federal government based on how those programs are organized. In Medicaid, about 60+% goes to the feds, but we keep 35-40%. What this bill does is really capitalize on what's new technology that is just becoming available that has a variety of predictive modeling built into our payment systems, which try and, rather than, as Senator Knope so aptly put, having us make a payment and then chase for that $57 million of revenue, has us be able to avoid making that payment when indeed the circumstances show that there's good reason to believe that such a payment or a claim would be fraudulent. The bill is well crafted to get at the issues that have already been raised. And it particularly says, one, first of all, we as a state should go out and do due diligence, do an RFI, look at vendors. But it says we shouldn't go forward unless a couple of things. Number one, we can assure that savings will be generated. In other words, we won't have a lot of upfront cost, and that we'll be able to demonstrate that this is of a value to the state. Number two, that we can integrate these systems into our current systems easily. And lastly, exactly the issue that was brought up, that we implement something in a way that isn't going to interfere with our paying current providers. That would be why we would go out, we'd do an RFI, and if we saw that there was enough interest and actually enough competency out there, enter into an RFP, and hopefully we would use our judgment in awarding that RFP to a vendor that would, A, only be able to demonstrate savings, and B, would be able to implement something that was not done in such a way as to in any way delay payments that were valid payments. So I think that this bill has the appropriate sort of safeguards built into it that doesn't have us just going out and doing something because it's the latest fad or whatever, but actually is based on a well-thought-out way of approaching this. And I think it's something that we'd be looking to implement, quite frankly, as the technology moves forward as well. So I think it's consistent with where we're going as a state.
So how long has your technology been developed?
Sure. So I don't want to pretend to be the one making the technology, but yeah. I do know it's in heavy use by the private sector. The federal government with Medicare is looking at different options along the lines, and okay. kind of
but
states.
Eight, 2 years, 5 years, 10 years?
I wouldn't want to answer okay. the question incorrectly. Apologize.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Any other comments?
Is there any? May I?
Yes.
Is there any known opposition to this at this point?
I mean, I think the question is always, concerns. Just if I'm a doctor, I'm going to want to make sure that this isn't going to delay my payments, which we found right. Washington State it doesn't, and that I'm not going to have to do something every time I try to send out a bill that's going to make life difficult for me, and it shouldn't do that either. So those would be the two that I've heard about that are kind of out there. And I think the way that the legislation was drafted addressed those.
Well, the hospitals and the providers are not here Well, yes, the hospitals are in the back room. But
everybody but behind us is a supporter.
But I think from the testimony, hopefully those who are listening or are in the room, please look at this bill seriously. And on the record, it says, you said that very few were flagged and that those that were, payment did occur within, you said, 24 hours,
yeah,
I
typically.
Think.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that hasn't happened yet. That was the estimate, right?
Yeah.
The estimate, right.
Yeah.
Yes, Dr. Goldberg.
You know, Chair Mona Sanderson and members of the committee, as I think everyone knows, as a state within our Medicaid program, we're not a very lucrative payer. And one of the issues that we work hard at is to try, and if we're not going to be lucrative, to certainly try and minimize as many barriers as we can. We're actually a fairly prompt payer. And part of our ability to work successfully with stakeholders is to not have those kinds of barriers in place. As, you know, the director of the agency, when we went out to do an RFI, and if we ever got to the RFP stage, I can tell you that one of the issues that we'd be looking very carefully at would be making certain that this didn't create more red tape, delay, or bureaucracy, but actually minimize that. There's a fair amount of, quite frankly, red tape and bureaucracy in pay and chase that is equally of concern to providers. We make a payment. It's felt to be incorrect,
wrong.
We go out. We have to we solicit records. People have to copy things. We go out to their offices. It creates a huge amount of expense, both for the state as well as for the practitioner. So we already have some of that built into some of our pay and chase systems by definition of the name. You pay and then someone's got to run faster than you. Hopefully what this does is adjudicate some of that ahead of time. And my hope would be, if we're going to be successful in something like this, we would implement it in a way at the state level that would minimize that kind of work, and otherwise it wouldn't be worth it for any of us.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. Dr. Goldberg made some of the points I wanted to about the due diligence in the agency to make sure that this structure right, but I would also point out that some of the pay and chase you never catch.
Correct.
Okay, and so that's just money gone, and rather than going to direct services. So pay and chase has been something, Bruce, we've been talking about for a long time, and and if this approach is going to make things better, it's worth going for.
And I know there's fraud in the system.
And it's not, necessarily fraud. Sometimes it's just mistakes. But
mm-hmm. Yeah, Madam Chair and Senator Cruz, that's an excellent point. There are several types. You know, it's waste, fraud, and abuse.
Yes.
And part of it is, you know, insurance payments or payments that otherwise would be owed to the state based on insurances that people have.
Yep.
And maximizing those things. But beyond that, about 20% of the fraud that exists in the system today is what's kind of known as medical facility, and about another 20% is like kind of durable medical goods, and so that represents a huge part of it.
Mm-hmm.
And anything we can do to save money as we're moving our whole healthcare system to a new model, that's what this bill was intended to do, and written, I think, pretty narrowly so it doesn't cost the state any money. And so I'm hoping that there won't be a fiscal attached to this. So, Madam Chair, so you could just move this thing right to the floor and over to the House so we can get moving on it.
Can I make one final comment? I think there's also a misconception about who's committing the fraud, too. And, you know, I'm in no way anti-doctor. In fact, I have an article from Fast Company magazine I'll leave with you, and it explains how to perpetrate Medicaid fraud. And essentially it says, you know, go to the black market, buy some providers' ID number lists, open a bogus storefront, hire a non-English speaker to run the bogus storefront and then start billing the system. I mean, it's just awful.
And we know that that's happened. We had testimony here, especially with the durable equipment, where they would set up front shops and get a lot of Medicare money that way.
I'm sure it would be nice if word got through the pipeline somehow that because there is no fiscal on this, that maybe the president might be willing to consider rescinding that referral.
That would be up to the agency, Dr. Goldberg.
I believe if you could pass that word along.
I believe we're giving you a fiscal that is no fiscal, because as indicated, I mean, this is really part of our work. We put out RFIs and RFPs. We have two vendors now, and since this wouldn't incur the state any cost, I don't see any reason why not. I don't know if we've submitted something officially yet.
Not yet, but, because we're doing a public hearing.
Okay, we'll get you an official statement that shows that and move forward.
That's great.
Thank you. All right.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right, any other discussion? Thank you very much, gentlemen. And with that, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 753, and we are adjourned.